This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents Sully by John Grisham. Read for you by Dion Graham. To the memory of Michael Rudell, 1943 to 2021. Not only the finest lawyer I've ever known, but a perfect gentleman and a loyal friend. Part 1. Chapter 1. In April, when Samuel Suleiman was invited to try out for the national team, he was 17 years old, stood 6 feet 2 inches tall, and was considered to be a promising point guard, known for his quickness and vertical leap, but also for his erratic passing and mediocre shooting. In July, when the team left Juba, the capital of South Sudan, for the trip to America, he was 6 feet 4 inches tall, just as quick but even more erratic handling the ball and no more accurate from the arc. He was hardly aware of his growth, which was not unusual for a teenager, but he did realize that his well-worn basketball shoes were tighter and his only pair of pants now fell well above his ankles. But back in April, when the invitation arrived, his neighborhood erupted in celebration. He lived in Lota, a remote village on the outskirts of Rumbek, a city of 30,000. He had spent his entire life in Lota, doing little more than playing basketball and soccer. His mother, Beatrice, was a homemaker with little education, like all the women in the village. His father, Ayak, taught school in a two-room open-air hut built by some missionaries decades earlier. When Samuel wasn't pounding the basketball in the dirt courts throughout the village, he tended to the family's garden with his younger siblings and sold vegetables beside the road. For the moment, life in the village was good and fairly stable. Another brutal civil war was in its second year with no end in sight, and though daily life was always precarious, the people managed to make it through the day and hope for better things tomorrow. The children lived in the streets, always bouncing or kicking a ball, and the games offered a welcome diversion. Since the age of 13, Samuel had been the best basketball player in the village. His dream, like every other kid's, was to play college ball in America and, of course, make it to the NBA. There were several South Sudanese players in the NBA, and they were godlike figures back home. When the news of his invitation spread through the village, neighbors began gathering in front of the Suleiman's thatched roof hut. Everyone wanted to celebrate Samuel's breathtaking news. Ladies brought pitchers of cinnamon tea spiced with ginger and jugs of tamarind juice. Others brought platters of sugar-coated cookies and peanut macaroons. It was the greatest moment in the village's recent history, and Samuel was hugged and admired by his neighbors. The little ones just wanted to touch him, certain that they were in the presence of a new national hero. He savored the moment, but tried to caution everyone that he had only been invited for tryouts. Making the under-18 team would be difficult because there were so many good players, especially in Juba, where the leagues were well-established and the games were played on tile or even wood floors. In Lota, like other remote villages and rural areas, the organized games were often played outdoors on concrete or dirt. He explained that only 10 players would be chosen for the trip to America, and there they would be joined by 5 more players, all from South Sudan. Once combined, the team would play in showcase tournaments in places like Orlando and Las Vegas, and there would be hundreds of college scouts, perhaps a few from the NBA as well. Talk of playing in America added more excitement to the occasion, and Samuel's cautions were ignored. He was on his way. They had watched him grow up on the village courts and knew he was special enough to make any team and to take their dreams with him. The celebration lasted well into the night, and when Beatrice finally ended it, Samuel reluctantly went to bed. But sleep was impossible. For an hour, he sat on his cot in his tiny bedroom, one that he shared with his 2 younger brothers, Chola and James, and whispered excitedly with them. Above their cots was a large poster of Niolo, the greatest of all South Sudanese players, soaring high above the rim and slamming a dunk in his Boston Celtics uniform, one which Samuel often fantasized wearing. He rose early the next morning and collected eggs from the family's flock of chickens, his first chore of the day. After a quick breakfast, he left for school with his backpack and his basketball. James and Chol followed him to their neighborhood court, where he shot for an hour as they retrieved the ball and fed it back to him. Other boys joined them, and the familiar noise of bouncing balls and friendly banter echoed through the sleepy morning. At 8 o'clock, the games reluctantly broke up as Samuel and his brothers left for classes. He was in his last year of secondary school and would graduate in a month. He considered himself fortunate. Less than half of his peers, boys only, would finish secondary, and only a fraction even dreamed of university. There were no classes for the girls. As Samuel dribbled off to school, his dreams were now drifting to colleges far away. Chapter 2. 2 weeks later, early on a Friday morning, the entire family made the long walk to the bus station in Rumbek and watched him leave for Juba and a long weekend of vigorous competition. They waved him off with his mother and sister in tears. He would return the following Monday. The departure was an hour late, which for South Sudan was quite prompt. Because of bad roads and crowded buses, the schedules were flexible. Often there was no bus at all, and breakdowns were common. It was not unusual for a bus to quit in the middle of the road and its passengers be sent off on foot to the nearest village. Samuel sat on a crowded bench in the front of the bus, wedged between two men who said they had been riding for 3 hours. They were headed to Juba to look for work, or something like that. Samuel wasn't certain because their English was broken and mixed with Nuer, their tribal tongue. Samuel was Dinka, the largest ethnic class in the country, and that was his first language. English was his second. His mother spoke 4. Across the narrow aisle was a woman with 3 children, all of them wide-eyed and silent. Samuel spoke to them in English, but they did not respond. The mother said something to the oldest child, and Samuel understood none of it. The bus had no air conditioning, and dust from the gravel road blew through the open windows and settled onto everything. Clothing, bags, benches, the floor. It rocked and bumped along the main gravel road to Juba, occasionally stopping to pick up a hitchhiker or let off a passenger. Once it was known that Samuel was a basketball player who just might be headed to games in America, he became the focus of attention. Basketball was the new pride of South Sudan, a bright promise that sometimes allowed the people to set aside their violent history of ethnic conflict. Generally, the players were lean and tall, and they played with a fierceness that often surprised American coaches. So they talked basketball, with Samuel holding 4th. They stopped in every village and took on more passengers. Full capacity was a moving target, and before long the younger men, including Samuel, were ordered by the driver to crawl on top of the bus for the ride and to make sure none of the bags and boxes fell off. As they approached Juba, the gravel turned to asphalt, and the constant bumping eased somewhat. The passengers grew quiet as they passed miles of shanty towns, then blocks of sturdier homes. 6 hours after he left Lota, Samuel got off the bus at the central station where swarms of people were coming and going. He asked directions and walked for an hour to the University of Juba. He had been to Juba once before and was again struck by its modern facilities, paved streets, frantic traffic, tall buildings, vibrancy, and well-dressed people. If he failed to make the team, he planned to continue his studies in the city. If at all possible, he wanted to live there and pursue a profession. He found the campus and then the gym and stepped nervously inside. It was new, cavernous, with 3 full-length courts and few bleachers. There were no intercollegiate sports in the country, no college teams with schedules and logos, no fans to watch the excitement. The gym was used for intramural sports of all varieties and for assemblies and rallies. At the far end, he saw a man with a clipboard and a whistle tied around his neck, watching a 4-on-4 scrimmage. Samuel walked around the court and approached him. Echo Lam was 40 and had spent his first 5 years in southern Sudan. His family narrowly escaped a guerrilla attack on their village and fled to Kenya. They eventually settled in Ohio and assimilated into an American lifestyle. He discovered basketball as a teenager and played 4 years at Kent State. He married an American of Sudanese descent and pursued his dream of coaching at the Division I level. He bounced from job to job, rising to the level of an assistant at Texas Tech, before being hired by a nonprofit to scout for talent in Africa. 2 years earlier, he had been selected to establish leagues and coach summer all-star teams in South Sudan. He loved his work and was still driven by the belief that basketball could make a difference in the lives of South Sudanese players, male and female. Taking his under-18 team to the U.S. for the showcase tournaments was by far the best part of his job. He had never seen Samuel play in person, but had watched some tape of the kid. A coach from the country had passed along a glowing recommendation, saying that he had the quickest hands and feet he had ever seen, not to mention an astonishing vertical leap. His mother, Beatrice, stood 6 feet tall, and the scouting report predicted that Samuel was still growing. At 6'2", he was the shortest invitee. On film, a video from a cell phone, Samuel dominated on defense but struggled with the ball. Because he lived in a village, his experience was limited, and Echo suspected he would have difficulty competing against kids from the cities. 20 players from around the country had been invited to try out, and they were trickling into the gym as the afternoon went on. Echo noticed Samuel as he slinked around the edge of a court, obviously a kid from the country intimidated by the surroundings. He finally approached and timidly asked,
"Excuse me, but are you Coach Lamb?"
Echo offered a wide smile and replied,
"Yes, sir, and you must be Mr. Suleiman."
"Yes, sir,"
he said, and thrust forward a hand. They shook vigorously and touched each other on the shoulder, the standard Sudanese greeting.
"A pleasure to meet you,"
Echo said.
"How was your trip in?"
Samuel shrugged and said,
"Okay, if you like the bus."
"I don't."
"Have you ever flown on an airplane?"
"No, sir,"
he said without the slightest embarrassment. Of the 20 invitees, Echo was almost certain that none had ever seen the inside of an airplane.
"Well, if you make my team, we'll fly halfway around the world. How does that sound?"
Samuel couldn't stop smiling.
"Sounds wonderful." "It will be great, son. The locker room is over there. Get changed in a hurry and start shooting."
Samuel entered a long room lined with small wire cages. He picked an empty one and changed quickly into gym shorts, a t-shirt, and his well-worn shoes. 5 minutes later, he was back on the court. Echo tossed him a ball, pointed to an empty basket at the far end of the gym, and said,
"Stretch and warm up, then start shooting from the arc."
"Yes, sir."
He dribbled away, using only his right hand, went through a quick series of rather lackadaisical stretches, and began shooting. Echo smiled at the fact that yet another 17-year-old was bored with the notion of stretching. Echo monitored the scrimmage while watching every move Samuel made. His shot needed work. On the plus side, he delivered it from the top of an impressive, fluid jump, but he cocked low at his forehead and his right elbow strayed, not uncommon for a kid with little coaching. He missed his first 10 shots. "Nerves," thought Echo. By late afternoon, all 20 players had arrived. Echo gathered them in a corner of the bleachers and asked each one to stand, give his name, and describe where he was from. Half were from Juba. 2 were from Malakal, a war-ravaged city 300 miles away. A few others were from the country, the bush. Echo's next order of business was the most problematic. He said,
"We are all South Sudanese. Our country is torn by civil strife, where warlords fight for power and our people suffer. But this team will be united as one. You will be followed closely by our country. You will be its newest heroes. The quickest way to get cut from this squad is not by a lack of talent or hustle, but by any show of ethnic rivalry. Understood?"
All nodded in agreement. Echo Lamb was a legend in their circles, and they were desperate to impress him. He, and he alone, held the key to a trip to America. They envied his coolness, his perfect English, and, most especially, the latest Air Jordans on his feet. He picked up a uniform and continued.
This is what we will wear.
He held up a jersey.
As you can see, it is plain, simple, reversible, something you might see in a gym class here in Juba. Gray, no color, no fancy logo. We wear this to remind ourselves of where we come from and of our humble roots. I wish I could give this uniform to all 20 of you, but I cannot. Only half will make the team, and I do not look forward to giving the other half the bad news. But 10's enough, and we'll be joined by 5 more South Sudanese now living in the U.S. My assistant coach, Frankie Moka, is holding a similar tryout in Chicago. We will meet his players in Orlando for a few days of practice before the games begin. There will be 16 teams in all, 4 from the U.S., the others from places like Brazil, the U.K., Spain, Croatia, Senegal, Italy, Russia, and I can't name them all. There will be 8 teams in Orlando, and we will play each one. The other 8 will compete in a similar tournament in Las Vegas. The top 4 from each tournament will meet in St. Louis for the national showcase. Any questions?
There were none. The boys were too shy to ask, and none wanted to appear too eager.
And just so you'll know, this trip is sponsored by the big shoe companies. You know their names, and they're being very generous. Some of the money is also coming from the Manute Bol Foundation, and some has been donated by other NBA players from our country. At some point, when we're over there, we'll write thank you notes and do photographs. There is a chance that we'll meet Niolo, but no promises.
They were too stunned to respond. He split them into 4 teams, assigned their positions and matchups, warned them against excessive fouling, and started the 2 scrimmages. With no refs to interfere, the play was extremely physical, and that was okay with Echo. He whistled a few of the more brutal fouls, but for the most part let them play. After 20 minutes of nonstop action, he called for a break and offered them water. As they sat sprawled in the bleachers, dripping with sweat and catching their breath, he paced with his clipboard and said,
"Nice work, men. Lots of good hustle out there. I expect that to continue because we are South Sudanese and we play from the heart. Nobody quits. Nobody loafs. Nobody goofs off on the court. Now, in about an hour, we will walk around the corner to a dormitory where you'll stay. We'll have dinner there, then watch a movie, then go to bed. Get a good night's sleep because tomorrow will be a long day."
Chapter 3. On Saturday morning, Echo marched them back to the gym, half of which had now been taken over by a city youth league. Confusion reigned for the first half hour as Echo argued with a recreation official and threatened to call someone with clout. An uneasy truce was ironed out, and the under-18 practice was given 2 of the 3 courts. Once the youth league coaches realized who Echo was, they grew quite cooperative. Their younger players watched Samuel and the others in awe. 2 assistant coaches arrived to help Echo with his day. They organized the first event, a series of suicide sprints from midcourt to the baseline, about 50 feet. Racing in 3 groups of guards, forwards, and centers, the winners faced off for a 2-out-of-3 contest. All of the players were quick and fast, but none could touch Samuel. He won every sprint going away. 1 coach then took the 4 centers under a basket for a rough session on rebounding and blocking out. Echo took the guards and forwards and, using 2 cameras, filmed their jump shots. Samuel had never had a coach break down his shot, and it was not a pleasant experience.
"A miss,"
was how Echo described it, but with a smile. They started at the beginning and with the basics.
"Think of all the shots you've ever taken, Samuel. Probably a million, right?"
"At least."
"And they've all been wrong. Time and time again, all you've done is reinforce bad habits. If you want to play at a higher level, start over, and start now."
They watched the film again and again. Echo had averaged 15 points a game his senior year at Kent State and knew what a perfect jump shot looked like.
"No 2 are the same," he explained to Samuel. "But the great ones have the same basic parts. 3 things. Start just above the head, aim the elbow at the basket, and take the pressure off your left hand.
Samuel was eager to be coached and tried to unwind his bad habits, but it would take time. Echo sent him to the free throw line to do nothing but shoot for 10 minutes with both feet on the floor. Before each shot, he was to say out loud, "Aim the elbow at the rim." The drills continued throughout the morning, and by noon, the boys were bored. Echo finally split them into 4 teams and unleashed the scrimmages. He again warned them about rough fouls and, for good measure, assigned an assistant coach to referee. He took a seat in the bleachers and studied every player. By far the best point guard was Alec Garang, a well-known player from Juba who had starred on every tournament team since he was 12 years old. A scout had passed along his name to some American coaches, and he was getting letters. The trip to the U.S. was crucial for his future. The dreams and best-laid plans were to play well enough to be noticed by an American coach, who would then pull strings and place the recruit in a boarding school for a year of elevated competition and more stringent classroom work. Echo knew every college coach, every boarding school, every high school basketball factory, and every rule in the NCAA handbook. He knew the cheaters, their bagmen, the schools to avoid, and the facilitators who should be indicted. He also knew that every kid on the floor right then in Juba needed an extra year of coaching and polishing before entering the rough world of American intercollegiate basketball. After showers and pizza for dinner, the tired players stuffed themselves into 2 vans and rode through central Juba to a modern shopping mall near the capital. Echo let them go with instructions to meet at the cinema on the first level promptly at 8 for a movie. The boys stayed together as they drifted from store to store, gazing into windows, shaking their heads at price tags, trying on caps and shoes they could not afford. Samuel had a few coins and wanted to buy souvenirs for his younger sister and brothers, gifts they were certainly not expecting. The movie was Focus, starring Will Smith, the most popular American actor in Africa. Though he didn't say so, watching it was Samuel's first experience in a real cinema. It was a thrill and only reinforced his desire to live in the city. But he also kept thinking of his brothers, James and Cho, and his sister, Angelina, and how proud they would be to see him in such modern surroundings. Watching Will Smith race through the streets in a sports car with a slinky woman on his arm was certainly entertaining. And Samuel, along with the other 19 players, believed in his soul that it was not just a dream. The Miami Heat were currently paying Nyolo $15 million a year to play basketball, money they could not comprehend. And Nyolo was one of them, a poor kid from the bush of South Sudan, a Dinka, now starring in the NBA and most likely driving fancy cars and living the big life. Back in the dorm, Echo gathered the players in a television room and ordered more pizzas. Growing boys who were tall and skinny and burning thousands of calories each day could not be fed enough, and they devoured the pizzas. They were curious about his life, his upbringing and education, and how he discovered basketball. Why had he not made it as a pro? Why had he chosen to become a coach? Now that he had seen them play, could he say they were good enough for a college scholarship? Could he tell who might just make it to the NBA? No. He could not. They were still growing, and their skills were developing and in need of competition. Some had plenty of natural talent, but all were rough around the edges and inexperienced. At least 4 of them would be sent home at noon the next day. At the moment, Samuel was on the bubble. Alec Garang was the number 1 point guard, with Samuel a distant second. Echo talked to them, listened to them, and watched them carefully. For young men who had seen plenty of war, poverty, and violence, they, at least for the moment, preferred to talk about basketball in America and movies and pizza and girls. Echo was always listening and waiting for words or comments about the conflict. Each of them had been touched by it. Each knew someone who had died or disappeared. But on that Saturday night, in the safety of a modern dormitory on a campus, the boys were safe. Their future was nothing but basketball. Chapter 4. At only 6 feet 2 inches, Samuel still had trouble folding his legs onto his bunk for a night's rest. Above him, his bunkmate, Peter Nyamal, was 5 inches taller and somehow slept with his feet dangling in the air. Early Sunday morning, Samuel eased from the room without making a sound and left the dorm. He strolled through the campus and enjoyed the solitude and again vowed to study there if, of course, things didn't work out in the NBA. He sat on a bench and watched the sunrise and smiled as he thought of his family back in Lota. He had never left them before, and they seemed so far away. At that moment, James and Chol were gathering eggs for breakfast while Angelina stood at the kitchen table with an iron heated by a fire and pressed her dress and their white shirts, their Sunday best. They would walk as a family to the village church for 9 o'clock mass. Samuel roamed some more and found the student center, the only building open at such an hour on a Sunday morning. He paid 5 cents for a carton of mango juice and smiled at a pretty girl all alone at a table. She was pecking on a laptop and ignored him. About a year earlier, he had actually seen and touched a laptop. There had been only one in his school, and for a brief period of time, there had been internet service in Lota. That, along with cell phone coverage, had been knocked out by the guerrillas. Roads, bridges, cell towers, and utility lines were favorite targets. They were destroyed so often that the government stopped building them. His mother, Beatrice, had no education. His sister, Angelina, was being taught at home by their father. How, then, was it possible for some young women in South Sudan to make it to college? He rather liked the idea. He had watched several college games on television and had always been surprised at the number of female students screaming in the stands. Another reason to play basketball in America. In a reading area, he flipped through the Juba Monitor, one of two dailies in the country, neither of which made it to Lota. He found a copy of the other one, The Citizen, and reread the same news. As he was finishing his juice, 3 college boys came in and looked him over, then ignored him. They chatted away in their big city English. Their clothes were nicer, their shirts had real collars. Samuel knew it was time to leave. He found the gym, and the front doors were locked. As he walked away, he saw a janitor exit from a side door. He waited a moment until the janitor was gone, then tried the door. It opened, and he walked into the same locker room the team had been using. The courts were dark, but the early sun was flooding one end of the building. Samuel found a bag of balls and, without even a hint of stretching, began shooting. An hour later, Echo Lam entered through the same side door, and as he walked through the locker room, he heard the familiar sound of a bouncing ball. He eased into the shadows and peeked around the bleachers. Samuel was glistening with sweat as he fired away from 20 feet. He missed, sprinted after the ball, dribbled between his legs, behind his back, feinted right, then left, all the way to midcourt, where he turned around, took a few quick steps, and fired again. Another miss. And another. The form was better, and he was trying mightily to break old habits, but the elbow was still straying too far, and for the moment, Echo didn't really care. The gorgeous part of his jump shot was the point of delivery. Off the dribble, Samuel pulled up and, in a split second, rocketed upward and flicked the ball away at a height few other guards could match. If only he could hit. After a few minutes, Echo strode under the court and said, "Good morning."
"Hello, coach,"
Samuel said, flinging sweat from his forehead. It was not yet 8 a.m., and the gym was thick with humidity.
"You have trouble sleeping?"
Echo asked.
"No, sir. Well, yes, I guess. I wanted to walk around and see the campus, and I found a door back there that was unlocked."
"I watched your last 15 shots, Samuel. You missed 12 of them, and you were as wide open as you'll ever get."
"Yes, sir. It will take some work, coach."
Echo smiled and said,
"The scouting report says your mother is 6 feet tall. Is that right?"
"Yes, sir. All my people are tall."
"When do you turn 18?
"August 11.
"You could try out next year, Samuel."
"Thank you, coach. Does this mean I'm done for this year?"
"No. You want to shoot some more?"
"Yes, sir.
Okay. Go to the free throw line. Keep both feet on the floor. We know you can jump. Take the ball higher. Aim your elbow directly at the rim and deliver it slowly. When you make 10 in a row, come find me.
Yes, sir.
The first drill was a shooting contest, held on two courts. Every player took 20 shots from the free throw line, and the hits and misses were recorded. The top four were then put in a shootout, complete with banter, catcalls, cheap shots, laughter at misses, all manner of verbal abuse.
"This pressure is nothing,"
Echo kept saying as he offered up his pointed observations.
"Imagine you're in the Final Four with a game on the line and 100 million people watching, including everyone here in South Sudan. This pressure is nothing."
Alec Garang hit 90% and won going away. Samuel struggled to hit half of his shots. They moved back 5 feet to the college arc, 20 feet 9 inches, and started with the guards. Each took 20 open shots in a row. Garang hit 11. Samuel only 4. The forwards went next, and Echo was not pleased with their percentages. The best hit only a third of his shots. Because every big man fancies himself a long-range gunner, Echo humored the centers with 10 shots each. Few found the bottom of the net. He broke them down into teams of 3 for half-court scrimmages. His tone changed dramatically as he stopped smiling, yelled more, whistled more, found far more deficiencies to point out. The gym became tense as Echo went on the warpath. A bad shot got a whistle and a harsh rebuke. Samuel rested and watched from the bleachers. It had been a terrible morning, and things were not improving. His shooting was pathetic, so bad that in the scrimmages he hesitated to take a shot. Hard to score when you don't shoot. He had guarded Alec Garang for 15 minutes, and the slick one had scored almost at will. Echo yelled and whistled and seemed irritated by Samuel's presence on the court. By noon, Samuel knew he was finished. After a break and some cold pizza, Echo divided them into groups of 4 for half an hour of incredibly dull drills, ball screens, pick and rolls, and such. One of the assistant coaches led 4 players to the locker room where a chalkboard was wiped clean and apparently ready for X's and O's. Instead, Echo appeared and addressed them by saying,
"Look, men, there's no easy way to do this. It's by far the worst part of coaching, but I have no choice. You are great players with great futures, but I cannot include you on this trip."
They slumped in their chairs and looked at the floor. Echo continued,
"We have some money for the bus rides. I wish you the best. Be careful out there."
Though he had done it before, it was still heartbreaking. The boys would travel by bus and on foot back to their homes with their magnificent dreams broken. They would continue to play and to grow, but he knew that none of the 4 would play in America. And without that chance, their futures were bleak. They were too stunned to speak. Echo said,
"Look me in the eyes."
All 4 eventually did. He said,
"I wish I could take all 20. But I can't. I'm sorry."
Peter Nyamal slowly stood and wiped his cheeks with the back of a hand. He said,
"Thank you, coach, for the opportunity."
They shook hands and embraced. Echo said,
"I wish you the best, I really do, and I hope to see you again."
The other 3 stood proudly and embraced their coach. An assistant led them through the side door and walked them back to the dorm. They quickly gathered their things and headed for the bus station. 2 hours later, the same scene was repeated as Echo said goodbye to 4 more. He hated this part of his job, but had learned that it was best to get it over with. As the team enjoyed a long break back at the dorm, Echo and his 2 assistants debated the last 2 cuts. He wanted to break camp with 4 guards, 4 forwards, and 2 centers, but the 2 bigs were lacking. The team would find help in the U.S., where a high school All-American named Doc Marial would join the team. Doc was a rising senior at a fancy California prep school and had already committed to UCLA. Most rating experts put him in the top 3 prospects in the country. He had fled South Sudan with relatives when he was a boy. Echo did not want to take either of his two centers, but finally settled on one. Neither assistant wanted to include Samuel, who, so far that weekend, had looked terrible on offense and mediocre on defense. Both rated him as the third best guard. One referred to him as a non-shooting guard. But Echo loved his speed, quickness, and leap, and he was convinced that the kid would put in the hours necessary to become a marksman. They finally agreed to cut one center and one forward. Samuel Suleiman was the last player chosen, though he would never know it. The players did know that some serious roster trimming was underway. Eight of their friends had vanished, their lockers and rooms cleared. Who would be Echo's last two victims? As they played foosball, shot pool, and looked at girls in the student center, they laughed and joked about who might be next, but it was a nervous laughter. Coach Lamb's favorite restaurant in Juba was Da Vinci's, a place known for good food and even better views. It sat practically on the Nile River on the eastern edge of town, and most of its tables were outside on a deck beside the water. He arrived first with a van loaded with five players, and they followed him to a secluded corner of the deck where he congratulated them on making the team. Moments later, the two assistants arrived with the other five, and when the boys realized that they had been chosen, they wanted to celebrate. Their frayed nerves were finally put at ease. Samuel had convinced himself that his long ride back to Rumbek would be a dreadful one. He had tried to imagine the pain of telling his family and friends that he didn't make the cut. They would be crushed, and he would never get over the disappointment. Now, however, the future was glorious again. He was headed to the U.S. to play basketball against the world, while 100 head coaches watched intently and their assistants filmed every move. He would proudly carry the dreams of his people on his broad shoulders and soar, just like the great Niolo. The players and coaches sat around a long table and ordered soft drinks and juice. The mood was joyous, and every conversation was about the trip, from the airports and jets, to the long flights, to the hotels and amusement parks, to the games and the arenas and all those scouts. Were they really going to Disney World? It was Echo's third under-18 team to take to the U.S., and he reveled in their excitement. Chapter 5. At 7 Monday morning, a van left the dorm again as Echo took four of his new players to the bus station. He parked in a gravel lot outside the bustling terminal and took the boys to the rear door of the van. He handed each a handsome vinyl gym bag with the South Sudanese flag brightly embroidered on both sides.
Inside, you'll find a new basketball, some practice t-shirts and shorts, along with some caps and other goodies. Before we leave in July, you'll be fitted for new shoes, but that comes later.
He walked them inside and said goodbye to each with a warm embrace. They thanked him again and again, and they hugged each other, said goodbye again, and got lost in the crowds. Samuel's bus to Rumbek left at 8:30, only half an hour late. It was not crowded, and he had an entire seat to himself for the moment. Beside him was his old duffel and his shiny new gym bag, which he continually checked on. It was already hot, and the bus inched along in city traffic. Once again, Samuel marveled at the city noise, the relentless horn blowing, the angry shouts, the friendly greetings, the rattle and roar of old engines, the sirens. Finally, the bus picked up speed as the traffic thinned and they left the central city. The road was still asphalt as they passed through the shanty towns, but soon became gravel. Suddenly, the bus stopped. Its passenger door jerked open, and three smartly dressed and armed government soldiers hopped on board. They wore identical khaki uniforms, maroon berets, shiny black boots, and all three had the same cocky smirk that was expected. Each carried a Kalashnikov rifle, or a Kali as they were called in many parts of Africa. Samuel immediately recognized the weapon because there were so many of them in his country. The soldiers glared at the passengers, the usual collection of harmless peasants, students, commuting workers, and didn't like what they saw. They ordered the first two rows cleared and sat down. One barked at the driver to proceed, and the bus was off again. It was not at all uncommon for government soldiers to hop a ride on the buses. They were given priority and no one objected. They expected to be accommodated and had the weaponry to get what they wanted. But their presence could mean something far more ominous than simply catching a ride from here to there. It was not uncommon for the military to accompany buses into the rural areas where bandits thrived and guerrillas waited to attack. After half an hour, it was obvious, at least to Samuel, that the soldiers were not just along for the ride. They were on high alert, watching the road, the traffic, the settlements, the trails. They whispered among themselves. One talked on a satellite phone. Cellular service outside of Juba was scarce and unreliable. The bus stopped in a village, and four passengers got on as one got off. Minutes later, they were back in the bush, the gravel road dry and dusty, the sun baking the fields and woods. The ambush happened so fast, it must have been carried out by experienced thieves. An open cargo truck suddenly appeared from a dirt trail in a bend and blocked the road. The bus driver said, "This is it!" He hit the brakes, and the bus rocked to a halt. The soldiers lowered their heads, clutched their callies, and prepared to attack. One yelled at the passengers, "Heads down, everyone!" Two crouched by the driver. The third moved to the rear and put his hand on the door latch. Then, the sickening sound that was all too familiar, the tack-tack-tack-tack of an assault rifle. Samuel ducked even lower, but was still watching. The leader of the gang was in the middle of the road, firing at the sky. Beside him were two others, just boys, probably Samuel's age or younger, dressed in their best imitation of real soldiers, a hodgepodge of leather ammo belts and guns on both hips, along with their rifles. One wore a white cowboy hat. One had on basketball shoes. They swaggered toward the bus, all three yelling threats, as two others hustled to the rear of the bus. A soldier squatting inside the front door said, "Go!" And all hell broke loose. The driver opened the door, and two soldiers rolled out and landed on their knees with callies blazing. The thieves were stunned, and their hesitation cost them their lives as the better-trained government soldiers wiped them out. At the same moment, the third soldier kicked open the rear door and shot the two thugs at near-point-blank range. The gunfire lasted only seconds, but it was horrifying nonetheless. One of the bandits managed to spray the front of the bus and shatter the windshield before going down, and the sounds of exploding glass and ricocheting bullets hung in the air long after the shooting stopped. Samuel, head still low, quickly checked on the other passengers.
"No one's hurt,"
he yelled to the driver. He walked to the front, looked through the pockmarked windshield, and saw a sickening scene that he would never forget. A boy of no more than 12 was walking from the cargo truck toward the soldiers. He held a rifle with both hands high above his head as if to surrender. He was frightened and may have been crying. A soldier ordered him to lay down the weapon, and he did so. He fell to his knees, touched his fingertips to his chin, and begged for his life. The two soldiers stood over him. One kicked him in the face and knocked him flat, face down. The other raised his callie and fired away, strafing the boy's back and head. Tack, 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 tack. When all was quiet, the passengers cautiously lifted their heads and watched as the soldiers cleared the road, then dragged the six dead bodies to the cargo truck and piled them together near the fuel tank under the driver's seat. In no hurry, they searched through all pockets and kept the money and valuables. They confiscated their weapons and found two sat phones in the cab. They turned a valve, drained the diesel from the tank, and let it run over the dead bodies. One soldier ripped off a T-shirt from a corpse, soaked it with lighter fluid, and wrapped it around a large rock. They backed away, lit the T-shirt, and tossed it at the cargo truck. Whoosh! The noise startled even the soldiers, and they stepped back again. The fire roared and engulfed the truck and sent thick, black exhaust boiling upward. Flames shot from the dead bodies as the clothing caught fire. Then the flesh began sizzling. The soldiers laughed and admired their work. The bus driver swept glass from his dashboard and resettled into his seat. Along with his passengers, he watched the fire and waited for the soldiers. On the bench in front of Samuel, a mother with a small child was crying. Samuel looked at a man across the aisle, but both were too stunned to speak. Eventually, the soldiers retreated to the bus and got on. No one made eye contact with them. The driver waited until he was told to proceed. As they drove away, Samuel looked through his window at the awful scene. His lasting image was the burning bodies. The road ran straight for a mile or so, and when it swept to the right, he turned and saw a tall, thick cloud of grayish smoke drifting high into the air. What would the next bus see as it approached? Who would clean up the mess? Take away the bodies? Report the incident to the authorities? In South Sudan, many obvious questions went unanswered, and survivors knew to stay quiet. The soldiers were laughing among themselves and ignoring the passengers. The driver pointed to holes in his windshield, said something funny, and the soldiers laughed at it too. After half an hour, one of them stood and walked down the aisle, looking at the passengers and their bags and sacks of goods. Samuel's new gym bag caught his attention, and he asked, "What's in it?" Samuel smiled and replied,
"Basketball stuff? Open it."
The soldier was Dinka, all three were, as was Samuel, and with the endless ethnic conflict raging through the country, he felt somewhat comfortable being among his own. Certainly they wouldn't steal from him. He unzipped the bag and showed it to the soldier, who asked,
"Basketball?"
"Yes, sir. I'm on the national team. We're going to play in the United States in July."
The soldier grabbed the bag and took it up front and showed it to his buddies. They removed the new ball, two practice t-shirts, two pairs of gym shorts, two pairs of white socks, and three caps with the South Sudan Under 18 logo on the front. They examined them, then removed their maroon berets and put on the caps. One of them turned and looked at Samuel and said,
"Up here."
Samuel walked to the front and took a seat behind them. They asked questions about the team, the tournaments, the trip to the U.S. One claimed to be a fan of Neolo and said he loved the Miami Heat. They asked if Samuel would play for an American college. What about the NBA? The bus stopped at another village and two passengers joined the ride. Back on the road and still sitting with the soldiers, Samuel asked,
"Got time for a question?"
"Sure,"
said the biggest talker, undoubtedly the leader of the gang. All three were still wearing the U-18 caps.
"Who were those men back there?"
"A band of thieves. Some nasty boys who've been causing trouble around here."
"But no more,"
said another with a laugh. Samuel said,
"How did you know they would stop the bus?"
One picked up a sat phone and smiled at it.
"They use these too, and we like to listen. They're not really that smart."
"So they're not guerrillas?"
"No, just a gang of raiders looking for someone to rob, rape, and kill."
"They would have killed us?"
"You never know with these thugs. Last week they stopped the bus on the main highway west of Juba at night. Got everybody off the bus and they lined them up along its side. Made the driver get on his knees and beg. Then they shot him. They robbed everyone, took their bags and luggage. There were two young ladies, one with a child. They took them back on the bus and raped them for an hour or so, while the other passengers listened. Two boys sneaked off in the dark and escaped."
Samuel glanced to his left and looked at a peasant woman of about 40. Her teenage daughter sat next to her. How close had they come to a disaster? The leader continued.
"You? A fine young man of how old?"
17.
"I joined the army at 17, 3 years ago. You? They probably would not have killed you, but there's a good chance they would have taken you and forced you to join the gang. If you resisted, then they would have shot you."
He lowered his voice and looked at the girl.
"She wouldn't have stood a chance. And the driver? Well, they always killed the driver." "Standard procedure,"
added another.
"I guess we owe you a big thanks,"
Samuel said.
"It's our job."
They removed the caps and put them back in the gym bag, along with the ball, shirts, shorts, and socks. the leader said.
So, when you make $1 million in the NBA, you'll come back here and buy us a beer, right?
All the beer you can drink.
We're going to remember that.
They handed back his gym bag, and Samuel returned to his seat. He was 4 hours from home. Chapter 6. There was no welcoming party at the terminal in Rumbek. Samuel saw no one he knew. The bus was hours late, and he was not expecting anyone to wait on him. He flagged a moto taxi and hopped on the back, clutching his two bags. The driver, a kid of no more than 15, handled the bike like all the rest, reckless and daring and determined to terrify his passenger. Samuel hung on for his life and managed to follow the custom of not complaining about the daredevil antics. The walk to Lota was 3 miles and would have taken an hour under a blazing sun. The taxi ride was 20 cents, so Samuel splurged and laughed to himself about spending big money now that he was a star. Beatrice was behind the house watering her vegetables when she heard Angelina squeal with excitement. She ran inside and saw Samuel standing in the kitchen wearing a South Sudan practice t-shirt, modeling it like he owned the world.
I made the team, Mom,
he yelled as he grabbed his mother and lifted her into the air. Beatrice hugged him back and began crying as Angelina bounced around the house, looking for someone else to tell. Finding no one, she ran into the street with the unbelievable news, and within seconds, the neighbors knew that their dream had come true. Samuel Suleiman was going to play basketball in America. A second celebration materialized within the hour as the village gathered on the street in front of the house. As Ayak came home from school with James and Chol, a loud cheer went up when Samuel ran to greet them. The neighbors brought boiled peanuts, sesame snacks, cinnamon tea, and mandazi, a popular fried pastry. Samuel proudly showed off his new weapon, a Spalding NBA street ball, and explained that it was made of durable rubber and designed for outdoor play. He tossed it to James, who passed to a friend, and before long the shiny new ball was crisscrossing through the crowd as the older boys passed it, held it long enough to admire, then zipped it to the next one. A radio began playing music as the day grew long and the shadows crept in. As the sun set, the most glorious day in Lota's history was coming to an end, and there was so much hope for even more excitement. Their native son was on his way. The family sat in the dark house until late in the night, talking and laughing and dreaming of what might happen in America. Back on the bus, Samuel had decided not to tell his family about the bandits, the soldiers, the ambush, the smoldering corpses. He would be on the bus again in early July as he headed back to Juba for the trip, and he did not want them to worry. Later, in bed, though, he could not shake the image of the young boy being killed for no reason. He was about the same size and age of Chol, who was 12. Who was he? Where was he from? Did he have family? How did he end up raiding highways with a gang of thieves? Would anyone grieve over his death? Would anyone even know about it? And though the soldiers had done their duty and probably saved a few lives with their ambush, Samuel was still bothered by the ease with which they killed and the complete lack of remorse over any of it. They had laughed as they watched the fire. They had reboarded the bus as if nothing had happened. Was it possible to kill so many and do it so often that they had become numb to any feelings? But they were young, like Samuel. Their fathers and grandfathers had probably fought the North in civil wars that lasted for 50 years. They had grown up with violence and killing. It didn't bother them. Now, with yet another civil war raging through South Sudan, the bloodshed and atrocities were only getting worse. Beatrice had a cousin who'd been murdered in a village slaughter only an hour away. Everyone in South Sudan had a story. From burning bodies to basketball glories, Samuel's mind raced back and forth when he should have been sleeping. He woke up at dawn and felt tired, but life had a new meaning and there were important matters at hand. He dressed, gathered his eggs, swallowed breakfast in 3 bites, kissed his mother goodbye, and took off down the road, backpack over his shoulder and his new street ball bouncing away. All alone on the dirt court where he had spent half his childhood, Samuel vowed to perfect his jump shot with endless hours of practice. He would see Coach Echo Lamb and his new teammates in just over 2 months when they reunited in Juba for a week of practice, and he was determined to handle the ball like Steph Curry, shoot like Kobe, and play both ends like LeBron. No one would work harder. No one would spend more time on the courts than Samuel. At 7, James and Chol appeared with their old basketball. 3 more boys arrived with theirs. The 5 became rebounders and feeders as they retrieved Samuel's shots and fed the ball back to him. Ball high, elbow aimed, shoulders squared, an easy jump. Samuel repeated Coach Lamb's instructions before each shot, and for some reason, he counted. After 200, he began to tire. At 300, it was time for school. He'd read that Kobe took 500 shots a day when he was a teenager. He'd also read that Steph Curry once hit 77 straight three-point shots in practice. He liked those numbers. At the end of May, Samuel finished his final year of secondary studies and was given a certificate in an outdoor graduation ceremony. There were 10 others in his class, all boys, and their principal reminded them of how lucky they were to complete their studies. Across their young and troubled nation, only a third of all boys got a certificate. 1 in 10 for the girls, and those graduates were found only in the cities. Samuel had applied to the University of Juba and been accepted. He planned to enroll there in the fall, though he did not have enough money for the meager tuition and expenses. If things didn't work out in the U.S., he would return home, move to Juba, find part-time work, hustle for student aid, and somehow get by as another starving college boy. He had seen the bright lights, was about to see even brighter ones, and vowed to seek a better life away from the poverty and violence of the bush. Those thoughts, though, were rather remote as he proudly held his certificate and listened to the principal go on and on about the country's need for younger leadership. He tried to listen, but his thoughts were on July and the trip of a lifetime, the incredible opportunity to play in front of college scouts. He did not want to spend the next year studying economics or medicine at the University of Juba. The send-off was not what the neighbors wanted. They fancied another block party with music and dancing late into the night. Beatrice and Ayak were grateful, but felt otherwise. They wanted their son to go to bed early, get plenty of sleep, and make a quick getaway. The family breakfast was quiet. They ate eggs and pastries and drank tamarind fruit juice, coffee for the adults. Angelina, James, and Chol were torn between the excitement of their brother's big adventure and the sadness, even fear, of him leaving home. The family had always been together, and the thought of Samuel going away, now or next month for university, was unsettling. He joked with his siblings and promised to send postcards, though mail service in rural South Sudan was virtually non-existent. He promised to call whenever he could. Coach Lamb, of course, had a cell phone and had promised to devise a method of calling home, though it seemed unlikely the family would get a call so far from Juba. When it was time to go, he grabbed his carefully packed gym bag and stepped outside where a dozen neighbors loitered in the front yard to say goodbye. He thanked them, hugged a few, then hugged his siblings. Angelina was wiping tears. Beatrice gave him a small cardboard box filled with food for the bus ride, and he hugged his mother for a long time. For the occasion, a cousin who owned one of the few pickup trucks in the village had washed the dirt and mud off and parked it in front of the house. The tailgate was down. He took Samuel's gym bag, tossed it in, and patted a cushion on the tailgate. A throne for the guest of honor. As the crowd inched closer, Ayak pulled a small envelope out of his pocket and gave it to his son.
"What is it?"
Samuel asked.
"It's money. Cash. From all of your friends. They collected a few coins from everyone, and the bank converted them to pounds. About 10.
10 pounds? Samuel asked in disbelief.
"Yes. That's far too much money, father."
"I know.
But you can't give it back, can you? Samuel wiped his eyes and stuffed the envelope into a front pocket of his only pair of pants. He looked into the faces of his friends and neighbors and softly said,
"Thank you. Thank you."
His cousin said,
"We're going to miss the bus."
He got behind the wheel, slammed the door, and started the engine. Ayak stepped forward and embraced Samuel.
"Mechas prat,"
he said.
"I will. I promise."
Samuel took his place on the cushioned tailgate, his long legs dangling almost to the dirt street. He waved at Beatrice and his siblings, nodded again at his father as the truck moved away. Ayak stood there, waving goodbye as only a proud father can do. Samuel returned the wave and wiped his cheek. He would never see his father again. Chapter 7 Echo Lamb was lounging in the bleachers with three of his players and waiting for the others to arrive. The gym, the same one they had used in April, was busy with a summer basketball league on one end and a volleyball tournament at the other. Things would clear out somewhat tomorrow, and Echo had been promised one full court for practice. He was desperate to get his team to Orlando and to a real gym for more intense workouts. He knew that for the next 3 days, his players would practice hard, but would also be distracted by thoughts of the trip. He saw Samuel enter the gym with his team bag and look around. Echo realized immediately that he was taller than in April. He called him over, and they went through the standard handshakes and embraces.
"How much have you grown?"
Echo asked.
"I don't know," Samuel said.
"Come on, Samuel, you've grown several inches."
"No way,"
Samuel said. Echo looked at the other three and asked,
"Right? He's taller."
"Maybe an inch or so,"
said Rick Kuol, a forward.
"You were 6'2" last time you were here, right?"
"Yes."
"Come here."
They walked into the locker room where a narrow board, 8 feet tall, was attached to the wall next to a chalkboard. Echo nodded and Samuel pressed his back to the yardstick. Echo smiled and said,
6'4". You've grown 2 inches in the past 2.5 months. What are you eating?"
"Everything."
"Keep it up. Taller is always better."
By dinner, all 10 players had reported. Echo gave them the night off, and instead of a hard practice, they ate pizza in the dorm and talked about life. The coach said little and wanted the boys to get comfortable with each other. They would live together for the next month, sleeping 3 and 4 to a room, eating every meal together, sweating buckets in practice, winning and losing and pushing each other to whatever limits were in their way. They would laugh and probably cry, and along the way, they would discover a small slice of America. Echo saw basketball as one of the few bright spots in his native land, and he dreamed of returning with his players and helping to build a new nation. He asked if any of the boys had encountered violence. Rick Kuol, a Merle from Upper Nile State, said that a relative had been murdered in a village burning only 2 weeks earlier. The man's family had fled and disappeared, and were probably hiding in a refugee camp. Samuel told the story of his bus ride home back in April and his close call with the bandits. Quentin Majak, a Nuer from Wa, the 4th largest city, had relatives in a refugee camp in Uganda. They talked late into the night, and Echo became convinced that he had chosen well. They were kids, just boys about to leave on a journey they could hardly imagine. They spoke the same English, though some better than others. Abraham Bowl, an Azandi from Upper Nile, won the award for the most languages. He spoke 5, 2 tribal, English, Arabic, and some pretty good French he picked up from a missionary. His dream, after basketball, of course, was to speak 10 languages and work as an interpreter for the United Nations. At midnight, Echo shut down the party and ordered them to bed. He promised tomorrow would be brutal. However, the next day began not with a half hour of painful stretching, nor with a round of Coach Lamb's much-dreaded suicide sprints, but with the most exciting order of business. It was shoe day. In the locker room, Echo stood in front of a stack of identical bright boxes with the Reebok logo on all sides. He explained that the major apparel companies, Nike, Reebok, Adidas, Under Armour, Puma, were not only sponsoring the tournaments in the U.S., but also providing plenty of gear. In a random drawing, Reebok had picked the team from South Sudan. Some of the players may have preferred other brands, but in an instant, they were forgotten. Reebok was now the favorite, as they happily ditched their old shoes and began trying on the new. Echo looked at the pile of battered, torn, and slick-soled old shoes and shook his head. How many hours had they pounded away on dirt and mud courts? All of them should have been discarded months ago. Every decent high school player in America had a collection of basketball shoes, some of which they actually wore on the court. For his players, it was Christmas morning as they opened boxes, held up the pristine Reebok Revenge models, and slowly, gingerly, tried them on. They passed them around and helped each other get the right size as all 10 seemed to chatter at once. Samuel's old pair were size 11s and had been too tight for a month or so. The 12.5s fit perfectly. At the rate he was growing, he wondered how long they would last. When they were all fitted and admiring their new shoes, Echo called them to order and began a mini-lecture on proper attire. They should notice that everyone now had the same shoe. All were identical. All were equal. In practice, everyone would wear the same shorts, socks, and shirts. Nothing else. No bandanas, no sweatbands, nothing to draw attention to the individual. They were a team of equals, with no stars and no scrubs. As a coach, he would strive to keep the playing time equal, at least in the early games. However, as they proceeded, it might become obvious that a player deserved more time on the court, and perhaps another player deserved less. He would make those decisions later. For now, everything was equal. He picked up a game jersey, the same one he had shown the team back in April.
"You've seen this before. It's a plain gray jersey with matching shorts. No fancy logo, no name on the back, nothing that says, 'Look at me.' We will wear these unremarkable uniforms to remind ourselves of the simple and humble origins of our people. These uniforms will constantly remind us of where we come from, and when we distinguish ourselves on the court, and we are asked why we wear such simple clothes, we will proudly say that we are South Sudanese. Our country is young and poor, but we will make it a better place."
2 days later, the team met for an early breakfast in the dorm cafeteria. Most had been awake for hours. The excitement was palpable as they chattered away and ate cereal and toast. Echo encouraged them to eat heartily because it would be a long day. They wore identical yellow T-shirts with the South Sudan flag brightly printed on both the front and back. Coach Lamb explained that such shirts were necessary because they would be passing through crowded airports and it was often easy to get separated. The words "crowded airports" only added to the excitement. Two vans unloaded them at the Juba International Airport. They were limited to one item of luggage, the vinyl gym bag they had been given back in April, 20 pounds max because Coach Lamb wasn't about to pay extra for baggage. With a flashy black, red, green, and blue national flag also printed on their bags, the South Sudanese under-18 team was a veritable wave of color as it filed through the airport's lobby and began getting second and third looks. Echo had not embarrassed all of them by asking who had or had not been on an airplane. However, he knew for a fact that none of them had passports or visas. Given the nature of the trip, getting them from the government had been relatively easy. As they stood at a large window and watched an airplane taxi away from the terminal, Samuel reached into his pocket, removed his passport, and stared at it, almost in disbelief. A passport. Their airline was Ethiopian Air, a major carrier on the continent, and one with an exemplary safety record. Echo had assured them that the flight would be safe, even fun. No one had doubted this. Not a single player seemed even remotely reticent about flying. When the Boeing 737 pushed back, Samuel closed his eyes and savored the moment. He thought of his parents and his siblings and already missed them. Would they ever have an opportunity like this? He got lucky and had a seat by the window, and when the plane lifted off, his stomach floated a bit, much like a good case of the butterflies before a game. At altitude, the flight attendants served peanuts and sodas, and Samuel fell in love with at least three of them. The flight to Addis Ababa, Ethiopia's capital, took 2 hours. They disembarked and killed 3 hours roaming the terminal, soaking in all the sights and sounds, and especially keeping an eye out for more pretty flight attendants. They boarded a 777 and flew 8.5 hours to Dublin, Ireland, where they stayed on the plane for an hour before taking off for Washington Dulles. When they touched down, they had been traveling for 26 hours, and they weren't finished. Because of delays, they had to hurry from one terminal to another and sprint to catch a Delta flight to Orlando by way of Atlanta. The thrill of aviation dissipated somewhere over the Atlantic, and when they stumbled out of the Orlando airport and into the sweltering Florida heat, they had been traveling for almost 30 hours. They folded themselves into three taxis for the ride to their hotel somewhere in the sprawl of central Florida. It was an inexpensive hotel just off an interstate, and Echo, always budget-minded, put three and four to a room and cautioned them against complaining. They did not. They were too tired.